It's, I didn't go back to Dallas for a PhD because they simply wouldn't let me. But after Dallas, I actually went for 2 years to Los Angeles, where I did an internship to finish my degree. And I thought, I'll be in Europe for the rest of my life, so why not use the time, not use the opportunity, and stay in the States for a while. And since I come from the overcast, gray northern Germany, I totally enjoy to be in a place for 2 years where you have palm trees. You know, where you have basically just one set of clothes in your closet, and you don't have to change between winter and summer clothes. So that was a real treat, and took me a while to get adjusted back to Germany during this winter summer clothes thing again when I returned there at the end of 98. I went there first to work in an English speaking international church plant, because the idea was to go to the major cities of Europe, since basically Europe, you know, less than 5% would attend any church at all on any given Sunday, and doesn't matter what kind of church that is. And in Germany, the situation is that in Berlin has 3.5 million people live there, but less than 1% are even considered evangelical believers. And that is that's a huge dropout. But still, our friends, you know, when we talk to them, our non-believing friends, they regard themselves as Christian. And it was interesting that one of Sophia's friends came up to her, and their oldest children are the same age. Like Lena is our oldest, the 5-year-old. I have 3 daughters that you saw maybe up front here. Lena, 5-year-old, Kaya, 4-year-old, and Nika, 21 months old. And we were together in a baby group when Lena was first born, like really made connections with unbelievers in our neighborhood to build relationships. And what happened once is that one of the families had their son baptized, and they went to the Lutheran church to baptize him. And while he did that, he had to promise that, or the parents had to promise that they'll raise their kid in Christian faith. And knowing that they do not live themselves, I went up to the dad and I said, I admire you for giving this promise. So I said, but would you like for me to explain actually, or tell you actually how you would raise this son of yours in Christian faith? And he looked at me and he said, no. So that's the situation, you know, that we have. Another 5-year-old, and the mom told, that's a friend that's who told Sophia of this, that her 5-year-old son walked up to her and said, my buddies tell that there's no God. And this mom didn't know how to respond. And then her 5-year-old son continued, but I talk to God, so if I talk to him, he must exist. So my buddies are wrong. And the same lady, they don't go to any church. You know, at least not regularly. But this lady also was taken aback, you know, when she heard or knew that we live on support, we live on donations from the States. And she asked Sophia again, and she asked, why is it that the Americans pay Amadeus to do ministry here in Berlin? Do the Americans think we're all heathen? But still, see, there's nothing of faith, you know, left in her, or nothing of faith that would have been built up into her, but she still sees herself as a Christian. And that is the challenge. And where we live in Berlin-Steglitz, that's the southwest part of Berlin, like the former, when the Allies had Berlin as their zone, like the four Allies, it was like the U.S.-American zone. And around our city hall, there's, if we take just a radius of 1 kilometer, and 1 kilometer would be, 0.6 miles or something like that. If we take the radius of 1 kilometer on the city hall, there live about 30,000 people. And there are about 7 churches. But there's not even 1,000 that attends those churches. So there are at least 29,000 people in that short radius, you know, who say, you know, God is of no interest to me. You know, God is irrelevant. You know, he has nothing to say to me. He's just totally, you know, overdusted and boring. Or as one friend of ours, before she made a decision for Christ, she had visited the States. And when she returned, she told me, the God of Germany is boring, but the God of USA is interesting. He's alive. And I thought, you know, what... We're kind of like back in the Old Testament days where each nation had a god. But to teach the Germans that it's the same God, the God they experience in the churches here in the States, he can be as alive, you know, in Germany if the people would let him. And so that is our ministry. And we started with public worship service in May of 2007. I think we are about the same size. Or we average so about 20, you know, when we're really big, you know, then we are over 30. Our opening Sunday on May 13th was like that over 100 people came. And it's funny. Instead of just being overjoyed, I started praying against the delusion or the disappointment of the second Sunday when all these guests will have left and we're just, you know, we'll just be ourselves. But God has really, you know, granted us grace. You know, people have started coming, but it's a very, you know, slow growth. And that's the reality, you know. For a Christian country as we are in Germany, for our Christian brothers and sisters to learn that they actually need to witness to their neighbors. It doesn't matter that they say they're Christian, because if they do not really believe, then those are just words. And I want to show you a video of about 3 minutes length that will give you a little impression of what Berlin looks like, and would also give you a little impression pictures or a little shots of movies now about our church. And we're serious about it. Without you, it wouldn't have happened. That even though we are way apart, you know, we are, if it fly, we'd be whatever, 12 hours away. Without you being here and praying for us, and without you being here and donating money to us, enabling us to live there, that wouldn't have happened. And so therefore we are deeply grateful and wish too that even though except for Lee, most of you do not speak German well. That once you meet all these people in heaven, that you'll be able to strike up a conversation. And like Ray Baltz had this great song, I would say, what would happen once he'll enter the kingdom of heaven, people will walk up to him and say, you know, because of you, you know, my life had changed. And it's also because of you, you know, that Berlin is changing. We really want to be history makers. Nothing short of that. But it's kind of like watching the ESPN Sports Center, and your team has played, and they're gonna show you, and you are all kind of like wound up and totally nervous because it's an important game, and you'd like your team to win. If someone would have told you the score, and the score is like. You know that your team was trailing, but in the end they won. You know, you wouldn't care. You know, if the review, like 1 minute before the end, and your team is still in basketball, still trailing by 12 points. You know, in the last minute they're gonna make three pointers and just do a dunk, and they'll win. And so you can just totally relax and sit back and just enjoy it, even though it's nervous. And it's kind of like what life is all about. That we know because of Christ. And as John 5:24 says, as soon as you have believed in what Jesus Christ said, you have eternal life and you have passed from death into life. And so you know that in the God Sports Center, you know, he'll say that you have won the game. And that is our confidence, that we say that I trust in the city of 3.5 million, there should be thousands prepared by God, you know, to make a decision for him. And it's our task, you know, to find them. And so thank you for enabling us to do that. And one of the things, you know, how to do that is by seeing opportunities. By having opportunities, you know, to speak up. By creating opportunities, you know, to do that. And that's actually what Paul speaks about when he writes to Colossians. And he writes in Colossians 4, verses 2 to 6. He says, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us, that God may open to us a door for the word, to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear, which is how I ought to speak. Conduct yourselves wisely toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious. Season with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. You see, if we think about opportunities, if we think about the people, you know, even passing through Branson, you know, the 7.5 or 8.5 million that pass through each year, you know, how to see that as an opportunity. I arrived here on Wednesday and heard from Susie right away that she has like a German patient, you know, that she takes care of, a lady who doesn't want to live anymore at the age of 59. And then Chuck gave me a call yesterday and said that this lady would really, if, you know, if I'd have the time, she would really like to talk to me. And also that Susie said, so for some reason she's kind of like shaping up and she doesn't want to just to pass away, but she has kind of like regained her spirits, you know, of life. And so I walked over there yesterday and I basically, I expected to, you know, as Chuck said, you know, to show her the door to kingdom and she'll walk right through it. It didn't happen. She told me she believes in reincarnation. You know. And still she said she's upset at God. And I said, so, but at what God you're upset with? The one who is going to give, reincarnate you? You know, or the one who is waiting for you? You know, like one, for a man it is set, you know, to die. You know, then there's the judgment. I said, so which God are you upset at? So it was an interesting conversation, but left me kind of like afterwards. I said, like, it's one of those times where you don't know what to do. Just drive to Krispy Kreme and eat as many donuts as you'd like because you're so inwardly, you know, upset that you need something, you know, to calm you down. But I thought too, you know, I went out of it and I thought, Susie is there. You know, Chuck is here. You are here. So if the lady will really make steps, you know, towards God, you know, she will, and she will have the right people around her. So what was an opportunity for? I don't know. In the U.S., you are very great at statistics. You know, just like whoever had many, whoever touched this ball this and this many times, who passed, who had an assist and stuff like that. And in the U.S., there's a statistic that a person to make a decision for Christ, they have to have, on an average, they have to have encountered a Christian 7 times before they make a decision for Christ. And so you never know if you're number 1 or if you're number 3 or if you're number 6. I wish my prayer is I'd be always number 7. But it simply doesn't happen. But to realize that whoever you talk to, as Paul writes here, you know, watch out that you take the opportunity and that your speech is always seasoned with salt. That's why, for example, I never put a Christian bumper sticker on my car because I'm afraid I'll make one stupid turn and they'll think, yeah, right, the Christians. So I don't want to mess that one up. But to see the opportunities, so to really take them and to understand that people need to be prepared, you know, to make a decision for Christ. And you don't know where you come into this picture. And not to give up, as Galatians says, not to give up, but continue to do right, because at the appropriate time, you know, you'll reap a harvest. That is God's promise. But so prayer, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. And I thought so too, through prayer, you create opportunities. Now that's something that I really hate to admit, but I'd rather have to have my time with God before the world around me awakes. Because as soon as I hear the noise of life, you know, or the children waking up, or the noise of traffic outside, I'm wound up. I want to do something. And then I don't have the peace and the quietness in my heart to really sit down and study God's word and to pray. But it's like Martin Luther, you know, who really changed, who was a history maker, who really changed the world, you know, by leading the Reformation, you know, in the 16th century. It's told of him that the more he had to do during the day, the more time he spent before in prayer. Something totally ludicrous. You know, it's kind of like a thought that doesn't make any sense. Why would you take more time away from your 24 hours by praying more, you know, if you have so much to do? You know, but he knew that first of all, you know, get right with God and ask him, and that God will show. And there's wisdom in his counseling, and there's different. You know, if you have thought up your way, that God still, you know, has might have a different way, that God still has a better way for you. And to ask God, you know, to release His blessing and your and the wisdom, you know, in you to really see what His path is for you this day. So do not miss out on prayer. Because prayer is the beginning, the center, and the power of life. That is what prayer is. It's not something that, you know, as when I made my decision for Christ at the age of 15, I asked my student leader, asked him, so why do Christians need to, you know, pray and need to read the Bible? And he said, because that's what Christians do. Well, it didn't motivate me at all. You know, because it's just, you know, why would I do that? You know, if it's just, you know, what I do. Especially if I know I can live also, you know, if I don't do it. But to realize that prayer is the beginning, it's the center, and it is the power of life. Then you start to pray. Because that's, you know, how you approach the throne of God. And for some reason, though God is omnipotent, He says He listens to prayer. And he watches us, and He seeks out those people who search Him. And also, it's also a sign of me understanding who I am, you know, in the eyes of God. I don't pray when I think I can do it. I really start praying when I know I'm not up to the challenge, or I might completely fail, like this morning. You know, very nervous. So I said, okay, the only thing is that I have to pray. And just to realize that that's basically, you know, in a situation, your whole life, you don't know what's going to happen when you'll step out this door. And therefore God says, pray, because prayer is the beginning, it is the center, and it is the power of life. And Paul says, continue steadfastly in it. And watching with thanksgiving, I think thanksgiving too, it kind of wakes us up. You know, when you realize there is something that you can be thankful for. Like this lady that I talked to, she didn't have anything to be thankful for, because her dad had beaten her up, as well as her other siblings. Her first husband beat her kids up. Her second husband died, even though he was healthy and expected to live to be 100. So she looks at her life and says, life is lousy. And then to switch the gears and to kind of like see, you know, what you have. Can you be thankful for something? One of the experiences in Dallas, and I don't think that Chuck even knows that. When I went to Dallas at the age of 25, I said I'll stay single for the rest of my life, because the ministry will be much easier like that, because you don't have to give account whenever you return home or when you leave home. It's just basically you and the ministry. But then I fell for one young lady, another fellow student, and started praying like crazy and changed my thinking, you know, about staying single. What happens is she married one of my best buddies in Dallas. That made me sick. Because, you know, because I had prayed, nothing happened. And I remember one night walking into a library on the campus at Dallas Theological Seminary, and picked up a magazine, and there I think it was written by Chuck Swindoll or by Tommy Nelson. It was about choosing joy. And he said, like, in every life circumstance, you can pick what attitude you have, no matter what your life circumstances are. And he said, because, like Philippians 4:4 says, again, I rejoice. So it says joy is not an emotion that flows just out of you by you being in a special life situation. Because if Paul can say rejoice, that means joy is a command, like love is a command. So you can make a decision to rejoice in your life. And I thought, how am I supposed to do that? And so I took a blank sheet of paper and made a list of my haves and my have-nots. And really made a summary statement of my life to see, what do I have that I could be thankful for? And what do I have not? And the list of my haves that didn't include like this love of the lady, or didn't include like a Ford Mustang, you know, from 67 or something like that. You know, but what I had, yeah, were the friendships, was the opportunity to be in Dallas, was my mentor in Dallas, was my family back in Germany. We left as refugees Latvia back in 1979 when Latvia was still a Soviet Union. So to have this opportunity, you know, to have escaped death or Siberia and come as refugees to Germany, that's a huge thing to be thankful for. And that changed my mind. And that night I went out on the campus and made a covenant with God that from that day on I really want always to have joy. You know, instead of my life circumstances. So you can make a deliberate decision how you address life. And that usually happens by seeking, you know, the conversation with God, which is prayer. And the rabbi once taught that experience of God can never be planned or achieved. And he said they are spontaneous moments of grace, almost accidental. And then his student asked, "Rabbi, if God realization is just accidental, why do we work so hard doing all these spiritual practices?" And the rabbi answered, "To be as accident prone as possible." Now that's what prayer is for. That's what prayer is all about. And it is, George Mueller writes, "It is a common temptation of Satan to make us give up the reading of the word and prayer when our enjoyment is gone, as if it were of no use to read the scriptures when we do not enjoy them, and as if it were no use to pray when we have no spirit of prayer. The truth is that in order to enjoy the word, we ought to continue to read it, and the way to obtain a spirit of prayer is to continue praying. The less we read the Word of God, the less we desire to read it. And the less we pray, the less we desire to pray." Life is sometimes so simple that I'm scared of it. And it just depends on me. You know, do I take God seriously? Do I take seriously, you know, what I know about Him? And do I put it into practice? It's interesting, one area of Africa, when Christianity started to spread there, converts were zealous about daily devotions. And they would find their own spot within their wild thickets around their huts. And they poured their hearts out to God. And after some time, these spots became so well-worn, you know, in the thickets surrounding the huts, that paths were created. And that made their prayer life public. Because what happened, if someone began to neglect his or her devotional life, it would soon be noticed by others. Believers would then gently and lovingly remind those in neglect, "The grass grows on your path." Prayer is the beginning. It is the center. It is the power of life. And you must pray. Because prayer, you know, as a way, you know, to search really this intimacy with God. You know, the one who created you and who holds all things, you know, in his hands. And also as a church that wants to grow, as a church that wants to fill up this room and then move to some other bigger auditorium. In the book, Dangerous Intersections, J. Dennis and Jim Henry, two authors, they wrote about prayer. They said, "Prayer changes things. That's what the church in Phoenix discovered after the pastor asked members to randomly choose 80 people from their telephone book. He then requests a daily prayer for these 80 people for the following 90 days. At the same time, he asked members to choose another 80 names from the directory, but the second list was simply laid aside, and nobody prayed for those people. After 90 days, members called all 160 people on the lists, asking them whether they would allow Christians to stop by and pray for them. The amazing result, says Alvin Vandergrind of the American Lighthouse Movement, was this. Only one person on the list of people who did not receive prayer was prepared to allow Christians to visit, whereas 69 of the 80 people for whom the church members prayed were prepared to allow Christians to visit, and 45 even invited them into their houses, offering coffee and named special prayer requests. Prayer changes things. And sometimes it's like the unknown warriors, you know, who do pray. But prayer really changes things. Like what's been said of Billy Graham, that there was, and I've forgotten now her name, but there was a lady, and they found out about the lady only years into his crusade ministry, that this lady, when she found out where Billy Graham is going to go next, on her own, she went to the city, just took a cheap hotel room, and started praying. All she did was just prayed for the crusade. And Billy Graham says his success is based on the commitment of these people who no one knows about, but who prayed because they knew that prayer changes things. And Billy Graham, he describes in his autobiography that in his young ages, a millionaire or a wealthy man came up to him and said, I could set up a fund that from now on, you never have to take care or think about what you're going to live from. I'll set up a fund that you'll be taken care of financially. And I don't know if I'd have had that maturity that Billy Graham displayed. He said, I do not want to do that. Because he said, I get these $5 donations. I get this $10 donation. And he said, people, when they'll hear that I'm taken care of, they will stop sending those checks. But with stopping sending those checks, they will stop praying for me as well. Because at every time one person writes out a check for even a small amount, it's combined with the prayer. He said, and I do not want to miss out on the prayers that are lifted up for me or on my behalf. Prayers changes things. And so it is actually the beginning. It is the center. It's what it all revolves around. And it is the power, of life. And then Paul says, do that so that he himself would be able to declare the mystery of Christ on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear. And I'm thinking like, if you could wake up someone in the middle of the night and ask him to explain like the book of Romans, since he wrote it, it would be Apostle Paul. He could just do it, boom, just rumble off and then fall asleep again. But even Paul asked for prayer that he know how to present, the truth. So he knows if it wouldn't be for prayers, he couldn't do it, and he couldn't seize the opportunity. And it's interesting for me too, is he sits in prison. And in this whole letter, the only prayer that he asks for is that he'd be able to continue with his ministry. So being in prison has not taken him out of ministry. And he is not praying for, ask God that he'll just, whatever, give me like this luxury condo that we're staying at, as we have treated so nicely, coming here to Branson. That we are just totally reveling, in your love shown to us. But Paul is not praying, for this, take me out of this prison and put me up in this luxury condo so that I could enjoy life. Paul's only prayer is that he'd still be able to continue with his ministry and that God would give him the opportunities. And that is that's a single-mindedness that I admire. Speaking of Billy Graham, when he did, like when you start speaking somewhere, you have like a mic put down on you and then you do the sound check. What I usually do is I retract back to my Latvian language and I just say something Latvian so no one understands anyway, but I say at least in my own ears I don't say anything stupid. Most people just say like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something like that. Billy Graham, when he does a microphone check, he always quotes John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And he says that when asked, Mr. Graham, why he does that, he replied, because that way, if I am not able to communicate the gospel clearly during the interview, at least the cameraman will have heard it. And so he saw even this pre-sound check, he saw that as an opportunity, to present the gospel. And so Paul says, conduct yourselves wisely toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. And the question is, how to do that? How do you see opportunities? And I would like to show you a movie, and I will ask you that there are going to be two basketball teams passing the ball to each other. And I want you to focus on the basketball team in the white shirts and count how many times does this team, the white team, pass the ball to each other. Okay? Okay. How many times? How many? 13? 15? Did you see anything else in that movie? The gorilla? Did all of you see a gorilla?
Yeah.
No? Please, will you show the movie again? And just watch. there's a gorilla coming in from this side, walking through, beating his chest, and then passing out of the picture. That is a very famous movie, actually, made done by sociologists who are studying how you can miss out on the obvious. Only 10% basically see the gorilla. You know, because the rest is, you know, you have been given a task. It's right in front of you, and you focus on it so much that you miss out on an opportunity. And I think that's what life is like. That you are so focused maybe on something that at hand that you miss out on something. You do not see the gorilla, you know, passing through, beating on his chest, and moving on. And I think the only way how to avoid that, to really make the best use of your time and to seize the opportunity that God has given you, is by praying beforehand. Otherwise, you will not see the gorilla walking through the picture, and you'll just do your business as usual, and you will miss an opportunity that God has given you. And then if you fail, if you do not see the gorilla, you know, how do you respond? Somebody asked Winston Churchill one time, what most prepared you to lead Great Britain through World War II? Then for a period of time, you know, as you know, Great Britain stood virtually alone, you know, against Nazi Germany. And this was Churchill's response. It was a time I repeated a class in grade school. And the questioner asked, you mean you flunked a grade? And Churchill said, I never flunked in my life. I was given a second opportunity to get it right. Coming up to Branson, I saw a huge signboard saying, there was this famous picture of Albert Einstein, you know, with his tongue out, and it said, he was no Einstein when he was in grade school. Guess he flunked grade two. So Winston Churchill's response, I have never flunked in my life. I was just given a second opportunity to get it right. That's the correct attitude about life. I do not fail in my life. I've been just given a second opportunity by God, you know, to get it right. And God is the God of second chances. So whenever you fall down, just get up and get moving, because God is working your life. And that is the promise from the Bible, that the God who started good work in us, he will complete us. He will make us perfect. So you do never fail in your life, but you just get a second opportunity to get it right. And I don't care how many second opportunities, you know, you need to get. This is what Paul says. Conduct yourselves wisely toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you are to answer each person. So do not miss out on the gorilla, you know, that passes through your picture. And you do that, you know, by praying. You do that, you know, by going up to God and asking him and asking other people to do that for you. And that you as a church, that you pray. Because prayer is the beginning, it is the center, and it is the power of life. Amen.